Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. I'm your host, Holly, and as always, I am so happy to have you here. Christmas is a time that's supposed to be filled with joy, togetherness, and celebration. But for some families, Christmas time is forever marked by tragedy. As we move through the holiday season, I want to take a moment to acknowledge those who are missing a loved one at the table this year. For anyone navigating the holidays with grief, emptiness, or unanswered questions, please know that you are not alone. Christmas can be especially hard when someone you love should be here and isn't. And my heart is with every family carrying that pain during this season. As you guys could probably tell from the title of today's episode, I am having a podcast pal fill in for me again this week. I decided to take the week off from recording and let a good friend of mine fill in. I do, however, have a Christmas case that I am working on that I am hopeful to get dropped before the actual holiday. So today I asked my friend Jen from Case Uncovered to fill in for me. Jen is a powerhouse of a woman when it comes to podcasting, bringing awareness, advocating, and giving back to families. You guys are going to love her, trust me. She is just a beautiful and genuine person, and not to mention, Jen has an incredible voice. I know voice is a huge thing when listening to podcasts, and I have to say, Jen has lulled me to sleep with her soothing voice on more than one occasion. But you guys are going to want to make sure to stay awake for today's case that she is sharing, because this is an unsolved murder that needs closure. The more awareness, the better for these cases. Check the description of this episode to find more information and for ways to get involved. Also, all of Jen's social medias will be linked in the description as well as her other podcasts. So go show my girl some love, follow her, like, subscribe, do all of the things. All right, y'all, I'm going to go ahead and pass the mic off to Jen. Much love to you guys, and I will see you soon.
Hey, it's Jen. Before we get into today's episode, I want to share something close to my heart, something many of you have asked about. You already know my work goes far beyond investigating cases. I sit with families, I listen to their stories, I walk alongside them when they're exhausted, grieving, or still fighting for answers. And through that work, I realize something powerful. People don't just need awareness. They need support. They need community. They need hope. That's why I founded the Reignited Project, an official nonprofit built to do exactly that, to take advocacy beyond storytelling, to turn compassion into action, to help ensure that families, survivors, and truth seekers don't walk this journey alone. Because advocacy isn't just posting a story, it's showing up. And that's why we didn't just build an organization, we built a movement. Because support doesn't always look like a headline. Sometimes it looks like packing toiletry kits by hand for a domestic violence shelter. Sometimes it looks like volunteers showing up for a missing persons awareness event, not because the cameras are there, but because compassion is there. Sometimes it looks like helping a mother craft the words to tell her son's story one more time, hoping, this time, someone will finally listen. That's what makes us different. We created four branches, each one meeting a different need, but all rooted in the belief that hope becomes real when people show up. We have the Hive, the heart of our community. This is where compassion becomes action. We show up in real, tangible ways through outreach, events, awareness, campaigns, donation drives, and supporting families and survivors in ways that can truly be felt. We have the Compass, which is our trauma-informed educational branch, offering workshops, programs, tools, and guidance for families, advocates, and professionals navigating grief, trauma, justice, or the systems that follow. The Ember Collective is our alliance network where we collaborate with media, ethical storytellers, advocates, and nonprofit organizations to responsibly amplify stories, raising awareness without sensationalism or exploitation. And then we have Shores of Strength, which many of you are already familiar with. It's now an official branch of the Reignited Project, and we continue the mission of providing families of the missing and murdered with digital tools and resources to help spread awareness of their case, share their loved one's story, and keep their search for answers alive. And here's what truly makes the Reignited Project different. We don't just focus on one piece of the puzzle. We bring them all together. Advocacy, awareness, education, support, collaboration, and community. We don't just tell stories. We stand with families. We equip survivors. We partner with organizations who are doing meaningful work. And together, we create change that lasts. If you're a nonprofit or advocacy group looking to collaborate, join our alliance network, or partner to expand the services we can offer, we want to hear from you. And if you're someone who believes in this mission and wants to help, whether through volunteering, donating, or simply showing up alongside us, you have a place here. Visit thereignitedproject.com to partner, support, or get involved. Now, let's get into today's episode. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Case Uncovered, where we uncover the most compelling and lesser-known cases while lifting up the voices of the missing, the murdered, and the families still fighting for answers. I'm Jen Rivera, and today I'm bringing you a case from Oak Cliff, an area right outside of Dallas, Texas. This is a case that began with fear, escalated through violence, and ended with silence. A case where a young man disappeared only days after multiple documented assaults. And yet, no one was ever charged. His name is Armani Dante Morgan. I had the privilege of speaking in depth with Armani's aunt, Robin Johnson, who has devoted the last 8 years to fighting for answers. Throughout this episode, I'll be sharing clips of our conversation. What happened to Armani didn't start on the day he disappeared. It started long before, with a series of threats, assaults, and warnings that no one listened to. And by the time anyone looked deeper, he was gone. 8 years later, his case is still unsolved. This is the story of Armani Dante Morgan and the question that still haunts his family. How did so many cries for help lead to silence? Before we talk about the investigation, and before we examine what went wrong, we need to begin with Armani. Because Armani is more than a case file. He's loved, he's known, and he matters. When I sat down with his aunt, Ms. Johnson, the person who has been fighting for him every single day since 2017, I asked her to tell me who Armani really was.
I am Robin Johnson, Armani Morgan's aunt, next of kin, and his advocate. Armani was 27 years old at the time of his sudden disappearance. And Armani was a loving person. I always wanted everybody around him to be happy.
Armani was the first grandson born into a large, close-knit family. He was tiny at birth, Robin said. Everyone wanted to hold him, protect him, and take care of him. He grew up surrounded by women, his mother, grandmother, aunts, and cousins. But the one consistent male figure in his life was his grandfather, who helped raise him.
My father was the only father figure in Armani's life. And by Armani being the first grandson, male in the family, everybody gravitated to him because he was the first male, because it was a house full of women. You know, even though my mom had two boys and four girls, still the house was dominated by women. And when Armani was born, you know, everybody wanted to take care of him because he was such a tiny little thing, you know, when he was born. But, you know, my dad helped to raise him, and everybody in the house wanted to protect him because he was so tiny.
His biological father had chosen not to be a part of his life. And when Armani came out as gay, that separation became even more permanent.
The fact that he was an only child, Armani loved love, you know, and not only that, he also longed to have everybody around him love him because his biological father was not present in his life at all, you know, throughout his entire life. He was ashamed of Armani once Armani came out and identified as being gay. And, you know, it didn't affect anybody in our immediate family. But, you know, that Armani really took that hard when his biological father didn't have a personal relationship with Armani.
That rejection hurt deeply. Robin told me Armani loved love. He wanted to make people laugh. He wanted people to feel safe. He wanted to be accepted. And he wanted to belong to somebody. He had a big personality. Charming, expressive, creative, but also a deep emotional awareness. He could read a room. And if he sensed sadness, even from a stranger, he'd make it his mission to make them smile.
Never wanted to see anybody with a sad face. You know, anytime he entered a room or entered a space, you know, and he detected someone wasn't happy, his main objective was to end up with a smile on everybody's face in the space, you know, which he occupied. And Armani inherited that from his grandmother, my mother. Our mother was a loving, understanding, caring person. And she taught us to have compassion for everybody, you know, around us, you know, and for our siblings and immediate family. So that's where Armani adopted that from.
But Armani wasn't fragile. He was tall, quick-witted, and strong-minded. People assumed they could bully or intimidate him, but they quickly learned otherwise.
Once he started to grow and get taller, he was so tall. Even in elementary school, that growth spurt, you know, he just began to grow so fast. But one thing about Armani, people couldn't take advantage of him. Even though he was a tall, thin person, people underestimated him a lot. You know, and wanted to try to bully him, and he just wasn't having it. You know, they soon learned that they couldn't push him around. And that's one thing I loved about him is the fact that, and like they say, you never judge a book by its cover. You know, when people saw that he was, you know, kind of withdrawn, you know, was tall and thin, they thought that they could just run over him and bully him. But he soon let them know that that's not how it's going to be. And that's what I loved about him.
Armani was also a latchkey kid, gaining independence early. He'd let himself in and out of the house, cook his own meals, and manage his routines. He loved music. He loved fashion. And he loved being around people.
Growing up, with him being around a house full of women, and him being a latchkey kid, you know, because when Armani and his mom moved away from our childhood home and moved into their own place to live, she worked and still works in the home health field, and Armani would have to leave home, lock the door, go to school, come back home, unlock the door, and let himself back in the house. So he was a latchkey kid. And by him being around a house full of women, he learned how to cook, you know, from just watching us. He soon learned how to cook, and he was good at it, you know. And one thing he did love, he loved music. He loved fashion. And he just loved being around family and people that really cared about him.
But as Armani got older, and as he explored relationships, friendships, and identity, he started seeking love and loyalty in places that weren't always safe. And that made him vulnerable. not because he was weak, but because he believed in people. He trusted people, even when they had proven they weren't trustworthy. Robin shared that after Armani died, people who knew him, even those who had been with him shortly before he disappeared, went silent.
Now, it's sad that he called some individuals his friend, but once we realized that, you know, he was deceased, those people that he called his friends, we never heard from them. They never went to law enforcement to give any information. And I was like, okay, well, these are the people that he considered his friends. Okay, so your friends show up for you, you know, and that was the disappointing part of it, is because he considered them his friends, you know, while he was still living.
That silence, even years later, remains one of the biggest sources of pain for this family. And it was around this time, just weeks before Armani disappeared, that things began to escalate. By the spring of 2017, Armani had started to pull away from certain people in his life, people he considered friends, people he trusted, people he believed loved him. But he was beginning to realize not everyone in his circle meant him well, and some may have wanted to hurt him. The first known violent assault took place in the week of May 22, 2017, at a strip mall not far from Armani's home in Dallas. A woman, someone Armani knew, someone he had once considered a friend, tracked him down in a parking area, along with her two teenage sons.
This female perpetrator, she and Armani used drugs together. And what she would do was, she would solicit Armani's help, and this went on for 3 years or more. She would solicit Armani's help because he knew a lot of people. You know, he was just a social butterfly. You know, he knew a lot of people. So she would solicit Armani's help with selling a portion of her monthly food stamp. Now, she has three children I know of, maybe four. And so she's taking food out of their mouths, selling a portion of her monthly food stamps in exchange for cash to buy drugs. So whatever went wrong with that regular deal, like when the drug deal went bad, is when she started tracking our money like an animal to violently assault him wherever she would find him, wherever she would locate him. And the first instance was the week of May the 22nd. I know a lot of people always want to say, refer to it as May the 22nd. It wasn't actually on May 22nd. It was of May 22nd that her and her two teenage sons tracked our money not far from his home. It was at a strip mall. And I'm assuming they were all going to this tobacco shop, because it was a tobacco shop, a place where this man sold food and cold drinks, you know, out of this place in the strip mall. And she and her two teenage sons cornered Armani at that strip mall, and they all three violently assaulted him. That was the first instance.
This wasn't a random attack. It was personal, and it wouldn't be the last. Just over a week later, May 30th and 31st, the harassment escalated. She began calling Armani's home repeatedly. Robin said it was all day, from sunup to sundown, trying to lure him outside.
The second instance was May the 30th, she started making harassing phone calls to Armani's home. And this was all day that day. When I say 24/7, she called that home from sunup to sundown on May the 30th. She couldn't lure him outside with those harassing phone calls. So the next day, she proceeded with the harassing phone calls, which was May the 31st. So since she saw that that wasn't working for her to lure him outside with these harassing phone calls, all of a sudden a bullet pierced through Armani and his mom's living room window. And so at that point, Armani and his mom both ventured outside to ask the bystanders, you know, did they see who it was that actually fired the shot into to the apartment window?
A gunshot through the window of his mother's apartment where Armani had been sitting. This was no longer harassment. This was attempted murder. Armani and his mother ran outside trying to see who fired the shot, but the shooter was already gone. Security cameras captured the SUV fleeing the scene, but the license plate was fake.
So once the gun bullet pierced through the living room window, Armani's mom went to the leasing office to ask the leasing manager to review the surveillance cameras to see if they could actually see who the shooter was. Unfortunately, the camera that was mounted outside the unit where Armani and his mom lived was inoperable. It wasn't working. But the camera at the front entrance where cars come in and go out, enter in the complex, that camera actually captured the license plate on the vehicle once she violently assaulted Armani because the gun bullet pierced into the living room window. Armani and his mom go outside. His mom travels to the leasing office on foot to speak with the leasing manager. Armani was violently assaulted right outside their front door by the known female perpetrator and her young daughter. And this is by evidence of a brief cell phone video. So once one of the residents went to the leasing office to notify Armani's mom, Armani is being violently assaulted. He's being attacked, right outside your front door. So as she and the leasing manager, Armani's mom and the leasing manager, go back to where he was being assaulted, the known female perpetrator and her young daughter jumped into the SUV and sped away, leaving the complex. Once the leasing manager did go back to view the cameras of the vehicle speeding away, the license plate number that was affixed to the SUV did not belong to the SUV. It was an invalid license plate number. So that day was her second violent assault against Armani, May the 31st.
Dallas police took the projectile from inside the apartment wall. But from that day until 2019, almost 2 years, they did nothing with it.
When Dallas police collected the, I want to refer to it correctly, the fired projectile. Now, it's a bullet when it comes out of the chamber of a gun. But once it leaves the chamber of that gun, it's considered a fired projectile at that point. Because until unless that bullet is whole, a whole bullet, then it's a bullet. But then once it leaves the chamber and it's no longer a whole bullet, it's a fired projectile. So Dallas police collected the fired projectile from Armani's mom and him and his mom's home May the 31st. I continue to ask about that bullet, Jen, for 2 years. For 2 years, from 2017 to 2019, I continue to ask this lead detective, okay, well, what is the status of the gun bullet? At first, he told me when I asked him, which was 3 months, 2.5, almost 3 months into him being the lead detective in charge of Armani's case, I sent him a text message. I started documenting things to where I could leave me a trail, because me calling and talking to him over the telephone just wasn't cutting it. So I had previously asked him about the status of the bullet, and he told me that there was no gun bullet recovered. And I knew better, because by this time, I had already obtained copies of the crime scene photos inside Armani and his mom's residence. So when he told me out of his mouth that day that there was no gun bullet recovered, well, if you want to get technical about it, there was no bullet recovered, but the projectile was recovered. Let's just put it that way. That's why I say I want to say it correctly when we talk about the projectile and as opposed to the bullet. And he said there was no bullet recovered. I already knew at that point that he wasn't telling me the truth, because I already had the crime scene photos in my possession that I had obtained through Dallas Police open records. So I continued to ask him, and as I continued to ask him, I would always text him or send him an email. I stopped asking him over the telephone anything. It was all, everything from that point going forward, it was either via email or text message, and that was on purpose.
Despite repeated requests from Robin, the family, and even members of the community, the bullet was never sent to a crime lab for testing. In fact, it wasn't even acknowledged in the case records for a long time. Why? Well, we'll come back to that. After the shooting, Armani stayed inside for several days. He was terrified. He was bruised. He was not safe. But by June 3rd, 2017, Armani finally stepped outside again. That same female offender found him again. There were now three known perpetrators, two males, one female. All of them knew Armani. All of them had personal ties to him.
Armani was violently assaulted by three known perpetrators. His same-sex partner was one of the three. The known female perpetrator who violently assaulted Armani on three separate occasions, even on June the 3rd, the day he suddenly disappeared, and 3 days prior to the day he suddenly disappeared, and then several weeks prior to the shooting at Armani's home, this known female perpetrator was involved in violently assaulting Armani. There were three different perpetrators, two males and this one female. But they all knew each other very well, and they all lived in the same community at one point, in the exact same community. The female perpetrator that violently assaulted Armani, and it was a personal vendetta. They all had personal vendettas. I have had several people ask me, well, what was the reason why they were violently assaulting him? They all had their own personal reasons and vendettas as to the reason why they were violently assaulting him. Leading up to his disappearance. The same-sex partner violently assaulted Armani when Armani informed him that he no longer wanted to be in the intimate same-sex relationship with him anymore. And so he started to get violent with Armani, and because Armani was detaching himself from him. And he's a known violent repeat offender, you know, who has been in and out, you know, of the jail system. And so he and Armani had been in a relationship almost 3 years at that point. And Armani just didn't want to be, no longer wanted to be involved with him. For one thing, he had a live-in girlfriend, and the live-in girlfriend was unaware that her live-in boyfriend and the father of her unborn child liked men. She had no idea. So when she discovered the same-sex relationship between her live-in boyfriend and my nephew Armani, she started harassing Armani via telephone, you know, and Armani would tell her, say, well, you need to talk to your boyfriend, you know. And the sad part about that, Jen, is that although we provided the detective with this information, they have yet to interview that girlfriend. And, beside the same-sex partner being violent with Armani and assaulting him in the days and the weeks and the month, you know, leading up to him suddenly disappearing. And so 3 days later, she tracked him back, because Armani, whenever he would get into these altercations with these known perpetrators, he would always stay indoors for days before he would even get back out to go anywhere. And so when he did venture back out, on June the 3rd is when she tracked him down again and violently assaulted him. And everybody wants to say he went missing from his home. No, he did not go missing from his home. He went missing from the area where he was violently assaulted, which was not where he lived. It was less than a minute from where he lived. So he didn't go missing from his home, which is what a lot of people like to say, you know, and that's just their go-to statement. He went missing from his home. No, he did not go missing from his home. He had been rendered aid and had left the area where he lived and went back toward the area where he was violently assaulted, and he was never seen alive again.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And so the second known male perpetrator, aided the known female perpetrator in violently assaulting Armani on June the 3rd. So that's where he became involved. But again, you know, all three of these perpetrators knew Armani and knew him very well, and Armani knew them. He was not violently assaulted and attacked by people that did not know him.
This is where Armani was attacked for the last time. He did not go missing from his home, like so many articles and reports have incorrectly stated. He was last seen alive in the area where he was violently assaulted, less than a minute from his apartment. And after that, he was never seen again. These were not isolated incidents. They were not misunderstandings. They were a pattern. A pattern that should have been recognized, investigated, and stopped. A stranger didn't take Armani. These were people he knew, people he trusted, people he had let into his life. And in the days after he vanished, those same people stayed silent. For most families, when a loved one goes missing, there's that moment, that instant, when they just know something isn't right. For Armani, that moment happened on June 3rd, 2017, the very same day he was last seen alive. Robin told me it wasn't the police, it wasn't the news, it wasn't even social media. It was something much more personal. It was silence.
My youngest daughter and Armani are a year apart. She's a year older than Armani. And they had more of a brother-sister bond as opposed to first-cousin bond. And she knew everything that went on with him. And the fact that she did not hear from him June the 3rd, you know, is what set off a red flag for her. Because if no one else in that family would hear from Armani, she would hear from him every day. And if she didn't hear from him, she knew something was wrong.
Armani spoke to his cousin every single day. Not most days, not when he had time, every day. And on June 3rd, 2017, she didn't hear from him. She sent messages, no reply. She called, no answer. She waited, still nothing. She told Robin, something's wrong. This isn't normal. At first, the family hoped maybe his phone died. Maybe he stayed with a friend. Maybe he just needed some space. But by the morning of June 4th, 2017, there was still nothing. No messages, no calls, no activity on social media. And that silence was their first red flag. One of the most common misconceptions about Armani's case is that he went missing from his home. Well, we know he didn't. After being assaulted on June 3rd, Armani was seen walking back toward the area of the assault near the strip mall, which is less than a minute from his apartment complex. It was broad daylight. He had visible injuries. And after that, he was never seen alive again. 17 days went by. The family filed reports, made calls, looked themselves. But the first real clue about Armani's fate didn't come from police. It came from a young woman whose number was found inside Armani's purse, which had been recovered at the scene where his remains were found.
When Dallas police or Dallas homicide detective, when they were at the scene, they collected Armani's purse, which had a phone number in it. And that phone number, Dallas homicide contacted that phone number. So the young lady's phone number that was inside Armani's purse, she was the one who notified us. It wasn't Dallas police. She notified us that a homicide detective had just left her door asking her questions about Armani. And he was in the accusatory mind frame accusing her because her phone number was found in Armani's purse. But her and her sister actually rendered aid to Armani the day that he went missing. So she, once she finished that abusive conversation with that homicide detective, she immediately contacted her sister. And her sister went to Armani's mom's door. And my daughter was there. My daughter that reported Armani missing, she was there when this young lady knocked on the door to inform her. She called her outside and she said, well, the detective just finished talking to my sister and they were asking her questions. And the questions they were asking her let us know that they found Armani. But she said that they wouldn't give them any detailed information, but the questions they were asking, you know, let them know, you know, because he had been missing for 7 weeks. So the fact that you know, detectives went knocking on her door 7 weeks later, you know, that was a true sign or key sign, you know, that they had found him. And you know, that's how we learned about Armani's, you know, discovery of his remains was through this person.
Think about that. Not a detective, not a victim specialist, not Dallas police, a stranger. She told Armani's family that detectives had been questioning her sister, asking what she knew. That's how they learned Armani was found. And still, it would take 7 weeks to confirm it. On July 24th, 2017, skeletal remains were discovered in a vacant residential lot just a short distance from Armani's home. It would take until October 16th, 2017, for those remains to be legally identified through Armani's mother's DNA.
When Armani's skeletal remains were legally and positively identified through his mother's DNA, Dallas police still did not do the respectful thing and do a death notification. They still didn't go to Armani's mom to say, well, we're sorry for your loss. We will be investigating you. That's not how it happened. I had to contact Dallas police because I continued to reach out to the medical examiner's office, calling constantly. Okay, well, you still don't have the results back yet. You still don't have the results back yet. So this one day when I called, which was October the 16th, 2017, I'll never forget it. And asked the death investigator, have you guys received Armani's mother's DNA buccal swab information back, test results back? And she said, yes, Ms. Johnson. She said, we can legally and positively confirm that the remains that were recovered July the 24th, 2017, indeed do belong to Armani. And I just fell apart. I dropped the phone. That was information that we had been anticipating, but to actually hear it, you know, so I had to actually, you know, gather myself and compose myself because I didn't want to call his mom, you know, in that emotional state to tell her, yes, you know, it's been confirmed. But once, you know, I got off the phone with the medical examiner's office that day, I called Dallas Police Headquarters to find out who the homicide detective was or was going to be that was going to be assigned to Armani's case. And the detective that I did speak with, he said, well, the medical examiners hadn't reached out to us to confirm, you know, that the remains did actually belong to your nephew. And I said, well, I just got off the phone with him. He said, well, she has to confirm it with me first. So, but he still never called me back. I still ended up calling him back.
Even after Armani's remains had been confirmed, even after his mother's DNA had been matched, even after the family had already learned the truth, Dallas police still never made an official death notification. No knock on the door, no call, no visit, no acknowledgement. And that would be one of the first, but not the last, signs of just how differently this case was handled. When Armani's remains were confirmed in October 2017, his family expected answers. They expected to meet a detective. They expected to hear about leads, suspects, or at the very least, an autopsy finding. Instead, Robin sat across a conference room table just 17 days into the investigation and heard something that made no sense.
17 days of him being assigned as the lead homicide detective in Armani's case. He sat across the conference room table with Armani's mom and I at Dallas Police Headquarters and said to us, looked us in the face and said to us that Armani OD in the vacant residential lot where his remains were found. And his mother came unglued. And we had just left Armani's graveside ceremony that day in the pouring rain. I mean, it rained like it had never rained before. And Armani was cremated. So the graveside ceremony was where his ashes, cremated ashes, were placed into a niche. It's a wall at the cemetery where families that have cremated their loved ones, it's a brick wall. It, each section has a glass door, has a small glass door just tall enough for the urn with the ashes in it to fit in. You turn it with the key and they can never open it again. So we had just left his graveside ceremony, which was November the 8th, 2017. And just so happened we had arranged, I had arranged for, that was the first meeting with this initial lead homicide detective. And I'm, like I said, he was in charge of the case 17 days. How do you look at skeletal remains, which were very few, only six, and his skull was one of the six skeletal remains that were recovered? And how do you look at skeletal remains and say to his grieving mother and me that he OD'd? Now, what person, regardless as to their state of mind, would crawl into some bushes in a vacant residential lot up against a tree to die? If Armani wanted to OD or kill himself, or however they want to refer to it, he could have done it at home, because he was always home by himself because his mother worked so much. If he wanted to kill himself, he would have done it at home. And what person, like I said, again, in their right mind would crawl into some bushes? Shot at 3 days before he went missing, but you say he OD'd in a vacant residential lot.
No toxicology, no medical confirmation, no autopsy ruling, just an assumption. And it didn't come from a medical examiner. It came from the lead detective. Robin later confirmed that no overdose was ever documented in the official records. It wasn't in police files, investigative notes, or the autopsy report. It wasn't written anywhere, but it was said directly to Armani's mother. That moment set the tone for how Armani's case would continue to be handled. A theory, based not on evidence, but on assumptions, would overshadow the facts completely. Now, here's what's surprising, is when the autopsy was actually completed, the cause and manner of death was undetermined. Undetermined doesn't mean accidental. It doesn't mean overdose. It doesn't mean suicide. It means suspicious, unexplained, and unresolved. But despite this, the investigation never treated Armani's death as suspicious. No homicide ruling, no forensic testing of key evidence, no search warrants, no interviews with the last people seen with him alive. Not one of the three known perpetrators has ever been formally interviewed about his death. And remember the bullet, the one that was fired into Armani's mother's living room window on May 31st? Now, as I mentioned earlier, Dallas police collected it. Multiple officers handled it. It was bagged, tagged, and placed in evidence. But according to Robin, for 2 years, it was never submitted to the lab for testing. When Robin pressed harder, she was eventually told the projectile would be tested, but by the time that happened, the statute of limitations on the shooting had expired. The evidence was submitted 2 years too late.
Within this 2 years, the statute of limitation on the deadly conduct where the perpetrator, female perpetrator, what we call her the suspected shooter, because until we can actually prove that she did it, put the gun in her hand, we have to keep saying suspected shooter. To actually hold her accountable, I want that statute of limitation on that deadly shooting shouldn't have never expired. DPD personally, Dallas Police purposely allowed that 2-year statute of limitation to expire on that criminal offense. Deadly conduct with a firearm, shooting into an occupied residence. Knowingly shooting into an occupied residence. So that 2-year statute of limitation passed while I continue to ask this lead detective about the status of the fire projectile. Now, 2 years later, June 2019, the assistant police chief at that time was the person that I obtained that meeting with. During that meeting, although it had been 2 years and the statute of limitation had expired on that deadly conduct, shooting into Armani and his mom's home, this assistant police chief still authorized and approved for that fire projectile to be sent to the forensic lab for testing. And my question kept being, well, why would a person, the assistant police chief, authorize and approve for the fire projectile to be sent to the forensic lab for testing after the statute of limitation had expired on the criminal offense involving this bullet?
Now think about that. They collected a fired projectile from his home just days before he disappeared, but didn't test it until after it was too late to charge anyone with the shooting. This wasn't just a missed opportunity. It was evidence mishandled. Robin tried to get answers. She called. She emailed. She documented everything. When the lead detective stopped answering, she reached out to Dallas Police Headquarters, asking to meet with the chief. They told her she needed to follow the chain of command. That meant meeting one by one with 26 different police officials before she was allowed in that room.
When I reached out to the police chief's executive assistant requesting an in-person meeting with the police chief to let her know my immediate concerns about how Armani's case wasn't going, the executive assistant told me that I needed to follow the chain of command before I could actually have an in-person meeting with the police chief. So that meant that I was being passed around from high-ranking police officer to high-ranking police officer to high-ranking. I mean, I met with 26 different police officers within the time frame before I was actually granted an in-person meeting with the police chief. And that in-person meeting with her lasted all of 2 minutes, 2 years later.
That meeting, when it finally happened, lasted 2 minutes. Not 2 hours, not even 20 minutes, 2 minutes. In attempts to group Armani's death with other tragedies, Dallas police publicly referred to him as transgender, placing his case alongside a series of unsolved transgender murders in Dallas from 2019. But Armani was killed in 2017, and Armani never identified as transgender.
At one point, it was several transgender females that were violently assaulted in Dallas, and one was killed, and it made national news. Malaysia Booker was violently assaulted in the complex where Armani lived with his mom. But that was in 2019. Armani was murdered in 2017. So DPD, Dallas Police, always tried to lump Armani's murder in with the transgender murders that happened 2 years after the fact. And Dallas Police was the one who referring to Armani as transgender. Armani never identified as transgender. Armani identified as a gay male who sometimes would dress in female clothing. And, you know, like I tell everybody, Armani wasn't ashamed of who he was. He wasn't ashamed of dressing female clothing. We were not ashamed of who he was. We were not ashamed because he dressed in female clothing, because Armani would still dress in male clothing. So he would dress the way he wanted to dress. You know, he would dress as a male sometime and he would dress as a female sometime. But closer to his disappearance, you know, he was dressing more often as a female, but it wasn't just him constantly dressing as a female 24/7. 365, you know, he hadn't gotten to that point. And if he did, then we would still accept him for who he was. But Dallas Police was the one that started referring to Money as transgender. So that's where that misclassification, you know, started. And Dallas Police wanted to lump our Money's death in with those transgender deaths so they wouldn't have to investigate. They tried to lump it in so they could say, oh, well, we solved another one. No, you didn't solve anything, because I'm still fighting for them to do a proper investigation into his murder. I'm still fighting with them constantly about that.
Because he was misclassified, because his case was grouped into a larger narrative, and because those cases were already politically and socially charged, Armani's case got even less attention. Fewer resources, less urgency, and more assumptions. So here's what we know. A young man was violently attacked multiple times days before he disappeared. A bullet was fired into his home. He vanished less than 60 seconds from where he'd been assaulted. His remains were found in a vacant residential lot just blocks from home. His death was never ruled an accident. Police never formally notified the family. Key evidence sat untouched until it was too late to act on it. And 8 years later, no suspects have ever been interviewed. This was not lack of evidence. This was lack of investigation. Robin began to realize that she wasn't just grieving a family member. She was investigating his murder, not because she wanted to, but because no one else was. She kept meticulous notes. She saved every message, every case file, every name. She logged every call, every date. She collected her own evidence. She even obtained the crime scene photos through Dallas Police Open Records. Robin isn't a detective, but she did what the detectives weren't doing. She tracked timelines, mapped locations, followed up with officers, demanded reports, documented inconsistencies. And still, she never stopped. When I asked Robin why she believes the case wasn't investigated properly, she didn't hesitate to respond.
It was due to lack of investigation. Bottom line, did not care. Because our money was Black, gay, lived in an impoverished neighborhood, and had a prior arrest history.
She paused and then said something that I think explains more about this case than any police report ever has.
It was bias and personal predetermined theory about our money, which negatively impacted his unsolved murder.
In 2021, a new law took effect, the Victims' Family Rights Act, which gave families of unsolved homicide victims the ability to request that police revisit neglected cases. Robin used it immediately.
They do very little. They do the bare minimum. Because once the Victims' Family Rights Act was signed into law, I want to say it was 2021, any cold case that has been cold for a specific amount of time, when the family requests that the law enforcement that has jurisdiction over their loved one case, they have to go back in to do something to say, okay, well, we've gone back in to perform or pursue investigation because the family asked us, because that's part of the Victim Rights Family Act law. That they have to do it. Like I said, he did very little. I told him about different people he needed to investigate. He would investigate one or two, if that. And I wish you could see his investigative notes, Jen. Have you ever seen a doctor's handwriting? A lot of people always talk about how bad a doctor's handwriting is.
Yeah.
His investigative notes were handwritten, and it looked like chicken scratch.
Dallas police reopened Armani's case, but instead of reinvestigating, they just reviewed the old notes. And most of those notes were handwritten, incomplete, and as Robin said, looked like chicken scratch. When I asked Robin what she believes was really standing in the way of progress, evidence, resources, time, she said no. It was something more troubling.
He was always looking for love in all the wrong places. And like I said, these people, they never meant him any good. And it's sad that the people that he knew, and he knew them very well, were the very ones that took his life.
People who claimed they loved him posted tributes online. Rest in peace. We miss you. We love you. But none of them walked into a police station to give a statement.
They would all post on social media, rest in peace, Armani. And I was like, okay, well, if you really want to help, go to law enforcement. What you think may not be of any importance may be something that's the key that will help move his case forward. And you know, that was so disappointing to me. And it still is, because I don't have access to social media at all. I'm not on any of the social media platforms, but family members around me will tell me that they see various postings still, you know, about people saying that they miss him and love him. Okay, well, if you miss him and you love him, go to law enforcement and tell what you know.
And that silence still today is the single biggest obstacle to solving Armani's case. Now, I've heard this said before, that cases go cold when people stop caring. Although we know that's not true. these families don't stop caring about their loved ones. Nobody has ever stopped caring about Armani. Not his family, not his community, not the people who remember him laughing in the kitchen while cooking, adjusting his outfit one last time before heading out the door. Not the people who still feel his absence. Not the aunt who has carried his story farther than the investigation ever did. After Armani's remains were confirmed in October of 2017, there were no arrests. No persons of interest identified publicly. No statements taken from the last known people who were with him. Not a single subpoena. Not a single search warrant. Years passed, but silence doesn't mean people don't know. Someone knows something. And Robin, she knows this case can still be solved.
There were several things that the initial homicide detective assured me he was going to do involving Armani's investigation. He never did. Then when they would get frustrated with me because of the amount of pressure that I put on them and constantly coming back to them about Armani's case is when they get frustrated with me and say, no further leads. So then that puts a delay, a pause. And then them thinking that, okay, well, they think I'm going to go away and never come back is where they're sadly mistaken. Because I tell them each time, this is not the last you're going to see of me. And I remind them of that every time. You look to see me again because I'm not going away. Those be my exact words to them every time. Despite his struggles in life, they still didn't give anybody the right to take his life.
Robin isn't just looking for closure. She's looking for truth. She's looking for accountability. She's looking for someone, anyone who will say, I was there. I know something. I'm ready to talk. Armani didn't just disappear. He didn't just walk away. And he didn't take his own life. He was erased by violence, then by silence. But that silence is not permanent because cases do not expire. And justice, especially in cases like Armani's, is always possible. If you have any information about the death of Armani Dante Morgan, no matter how small it may seem, please contact Dallas Crime Stoppers at 214-373-8477. You can remain anonymous. Your tip could be the one that finally brings justice to Armani and brings answers to his family. I'll also leave all of the information in the show notes below. I want to personally thank Armani's aunt, Robin Johnson, for partnering with me to bring you this episode. Thank you so much for joining me today for this episode of Case Uncovered and for listening to Armani's story. Make sure to connect with me on Instagram and Facebook at Jen Rivera Investigates. Until next time, stay curious, stay vigilant, and stay safe out there. Media.
QTS is building more than a data center in Dane County. We're partnering with Alliant Energy to enable 750 megawatts of new renewable energy sources, supporting sustainable generation while lowering costs. We use a closed-loop, water-free cooling system that conserves billions of gallons of water each year. And we're investing millions locally, from scholarships and workforce development to nonprofits and first responders. QTS, powered by people, driven by purpose. Paid for by QTS.